Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The impact of wildfires in California have enveloped communities hundreds of miles from burning acres. We have lived through hazardous smoke. And for the past 5 years, scientists at UC Davis have been studying how the wildfire smoke from these fires is impacting pregnant people and their children before and after birth. The study is part of a national effort to better understand and respond to wildfires and other environmental disasters. Researchers with the university's Environmental Health Sciences Center have already collected data from women affected by wildfires in Northern California from 2018 to 2020. Now they're seeking those who were pregnant during wildfires such as last summer's Caldor and Dixie fires. Joining us now is Dr. Rebecca Schmidt, the lead scientist for the study at UC Davis, to share the ongoing research and also how those who are interested can participate. Dr. Schmidt, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you're the lead researcher on what's called the Be Safe study. Can you explain more about the study and its origin story?
Yeah, so it's the Be Safe Biospecimens Assessment of Fire Effects. So it's looking at how these fires are impacting both mothers and their developing babies, and to see what maybe the long-term consequences could be down the road.
What prompted this study?
So back when the 2017 wildfires hit Napa and Sonoma, we had a lot of mothers in our other pregnancy studies asking us how concerned they should be about how whether their baby's being exposed to this smoke while they're pregnant. And what we could tell them kind of what we know about generally on air pollution, like from traffic and other sources. But we really didn't have much data out there on what wildfire smoke, and especially these new wildfires that are hitting these big urban areas, how that could be impacting their health and their baby's health.
Now, with the perspective of 5 years of doing research and ongoing wildfires, what have you learned so far?
Yeah, so there have been reports showing that there are some birth outcomes that are associated with these wildfires. And so some of those include having lower birth weight babies and a shorter gestational age, so they're born a little bit early. And while those impacts don't seem that big, they are important to note because it could be showing that there are impacts on the developing child. And so what we want to do is really learn more about how both what the mom is exposed to during these wildfire events, and then how much of that's getting to the baby. And then again, if there are any what kind of biologic changes that could lead to and how that might affect their health down the road.
How many pregnant participants have you had so far?
Yeah, so we're just over 500, which we're excited about. And this will be kind of the last round of recruitment for that's funded right now. We're hoping to get more funding to keep going. But so we're hoping to get kind of one last batch from this, the 2021 fires, so both the Dixie and the Caldor fires and other fires that broke out last year. And so because all these wildfires are a little bit different, so they have kind of different exposures associated with them and maybe have different responses. So we're trying to figure out kind of across all these wildfires what's most important.
How so? How are the effects of wildfires different from one to the next?
Yeah, so it just kind of depends on what's burning. So if it hits, you know, certain urban areas, there are different things burning, which may put different combustion products into the air. And so, and depending on, you know, each mother is exposed at different times during pregnancy, and people react differently. So we're kind of across all of those different things, we need kind of large numbers to be able to tease some of those things apart.
Yeah, I've noticed that when I've personally covered wildfires, the difference between a forest fire versus in a neighborhood where you have homes and materials and different particulate matter. When it comes to those who you're specifically looking for to recruit for the next leg of this study, who are you looking for?
Yeah, so it's open pretty broadly to anyone who was in Northern California and was pregnant since last July of 2021. So anyone who's 18 or older, speaks English or Spanish, and has been living in the area within 2-hour drive of Sacramento, we were willing to go out to you, and we're excited to have people participate.
All right. So we know like the Dixie fire was in Plumas County, but when you're talking about 2 hours, and as we all have lived through, smoke travels for hundreds of miles.
Definitely. Yeah. So when these events happen, the smoke blankets entire areas in up to weeks. And so this is the kind of thing where we kind of want to know how those exposures are different from more ambient air pollution that's kind of more chronic and there all the time.
Mm. What sort of samples are you taking from the participants?
Yeah, so we're collecting blood and hair and urine. And if we can get the moms before they deliver, we try to meet them at delivery and get placenta and cord blood and various other specimens like toenails and things like that.
Yeah, I guess if you can kind of unpack, we could start with the placenta. What have you learned when taking that sample from some of these participants?
Yeah, so in some of our other pregnancy studies, we found that the placenta is really important because it regulates a lot of things during pregnancy. And so there's a lot of markers of earlier events in gestation that we can see in the placenta. So we haven't actually looked at the ones for our BeSafe study yet. There have been other groups that have looked at placenta and did notice that there are carbon deposits in the placenta. So it's showing that the exposure is getting to the placenta. But we haven't looked at ours yet. And then some of the other things that have come out that we have looked at are we've looked in the blood of moms that were pregnant in the 2017 fires. And I guess on a good note, we looked at a lot of different compounds that are kind of hazardous that might be affiliated with wildfire smoke, things like PCBs and PBDs, which are flame retardants and things like that, that persist in the blood. And we didn't see big differences between moms that were exposed to fire smoke versus those who weren't. So that's kind of reassuring.
Going back
for those term ones. Yeah.
Going back to the 2017 wildfires in Wine Country, are you still following up with these participants, you know, 5 years later?
We're hoping to go back to them when we get new funding. So we're kind of staying in touch as much as we can. But yeah, so we're hoping to kind of create this group that we can come back to and then find out more about their kids and how they're doing.
Got it. When it comes to those who are going to be upcoming participants, what are the potential benefits and risks in taking part in this study?
Yeah, so the big benefit is really not so much for that mom and that baby, but for more informing for future wildfires. If we can learn more about, you know, what exposures might be harmful, if there are these impacts on health, then we can learn more about how we might be able to mitigate those effects. And so that's kind of the main goal of this study is to be able to help future pregnancies. For these moms, we can give them information on kind of how to lower their smoke exposure because we think in general, it's not good to be breathing in wildfire smoke or any smoke for that matter while you're pregnant. And so we, can offer that kind of information to them. But for the individual families, the biggest thing is to be able to help other families.
Yeah, I would imagine, given that 12 of the 20 largest wildfires recorded in state history have occurred over the last 5 years when your research began, I would imagine that has just deepened the importance of continuing this type of research.
Yeah, we really do have a lot more to learn about, you know, what timing is the most important and what compounds might be the most important to avoid and whether those are, whether we can avoid those by wearing an N95 mask or using a certain air filter and those kinds of things. So they're down the road. The more we learn, the more we can kind of do to control these exposures and then any resulting health impacts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and if you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Rebecca Schmidt, an epidemiologist with UC Davis, about an ongoing study researching the effects of wildfire smoke on pregnancies in Northern California. You've also partnered with colleagues at UC Davis's Primate Research Center, and they just released their research on the impacts of wildfire smoke on monkeys born just before the 2008 wildfire season. What did you learn from them, and how do you plan to apply their findings to your study?
Yeah, so there have been actually quite a few studies coming out of there now. So anytime these smoke events kind of hit these large areas, a lot of times they do hit our primate center, and we do keep macaques outside, and they live and breathe the same smoke. And they're probably more exposed because they're out there all the time. And so we do have pregnant monkeys at the time of these fires. And so we were able to follow them forward. And so there have been a few findings. One is that some of these infant monkeys grow up to have some respiratory effects. And so that's one thing that we're, hoping to follow up also in these children. A more recent study did show a couple things, that birth rate was lower during these wildfire events. So that's something that we hasn't been looked at as much yet in humans. And so that's something we plan to do down the road on a larger scale. And then there's also studies recently showing that there's some behavioral impacts of the monkeys that of the pregnant monkeys at the time of these fires. And so, and again, some immune changes and other things that might be important to follow up and see if we're seeing similar things in human babies.
Yeah. When you're talking about behavior, I mean, what do you mean in terms of when it comes to the findings with the monkeys that were being researched?
Yeah. So the monkeys, you know, they're not people, but some of these, they can look at things like social interaction and, how they respond to certain cues and things. And so they're just seeing these differences in how the monkeys that were exposed to smoke during pregnancy versus ones that weren't. And so this is kind of they regularly check the behavior and do these regular assessments on all newborns. And so that this was kind of comparing the ones in wildfire years versus other years, and they are seeing differences.
What do we already know when it comes to humans and the impact of other types of air pollution on health and neurodevelopmental conditions?
Yeah, so in general, ambient air pollution, like from traffic-related air pollutants, has been linked to many different behavioral and neurodevelopmental outcomes. So things like autism and lower cognition, so other important outcomes like that. And those are the kinds of things that we're But that's because they're exposed, it's a different exposure. So they're exposed all the way through pregnancy and early life, so those first years of life as well. And so we don't know how, and the levels that they're exposed to from those, like in terms of particulate matter and our concentrations, are much lower than we're seeing in these wildfires. So here we have a much higher concentration of particulate matter in these wildfire events. It's on the order of like 100 times more, but we're having shorter periods of exposure. So we really just don't know in terms of, you know, we know bodies are responding a bit differently to these kinds of exposures. And we don't know how that translates to the health of the baby yet.
Right. So higher concentration, shorter period, but not really having an accurate comparison to just ongoing exposure at a lower level.
Right.
When it comes to Be Safe and the study that you're currently researching, in the press release, it said that participants won't receive individual results about the exposures measured. I guess, can you explain why?
Yeah, so this is kind of there's a rules on reporting back. And so if it's something that we're testing that's a clinical measure, then we would be able to. We don't have plans to do anything like that so much. It's more looking at exposures and kind of these more subtle differences in biologic responses where there's not like a clinical standard that you can compare it to. The one exception to that is like heavy metals, because there are certain levels, although we were looking in hair. So there aren't standards for hair, but we can tell if they have higher versus other people and that kind of thing. So we have kind of looked into that for a smaller number of women. And we have seen some spikes in certain metals associated with these wildfire smoke exposures. But luckily, none of the ones that are really concerning, like lead and mercury, are these things that we know are linked to adverse outcomes. So in general, we aren't allowed to kind of give you anything that we don't know how to interpret.
That leads me to my next question, because also in the press release, it said there is not yet meaning in terms of clinical decisions they might make for themselves or their families.
Right. So it's really learning more about what we should be looking at this point down the road. So if we do get funding to follow up these kids for things like respiratory outcomes and neurodevelopmental outcomes, where there are some standards and clinical actions that would be recommended, we would definitely get them those recommendations and give that information back to the families.
So for those who are listening and they're interested in potentially participating in your research, what should they know? Where should they head?
Yeah, so they can just Google Be Safe Wildfire Pregnancy Study at UC Davis, or go to our Environmental Health Sciences Center, also has information on these wildfire studies.
And finally, you know, we are in the midst of another wildfire season, which potentially could be long and intense in Northern California. What is your advice to those who are pregnant to just stay best protected for themselves and their children and their families?
Yeah, so the most important thing, I think, at this point is to stock up on air filters before they start getting sparse to find in wildfire season. And make sure you change those and keep your house, the windows closed, and keep some sort of air filtration on. So whether it's air conditioning or even just a house fan, keeping those filters, moving the air is helpful, and avoiding being outdoors as much as possible. But when you are outdoors, wear an N95 mask, because that helps keep a lot of the particulate matter out. Yeah, and those are kind of the main things we recommend at this point.
Do you know how long an N95 mask is effective and when you should replace it?
That's a great question. I know I've used many of mine more than I should.
Same.
Yeah. Usually, I think they recommend, like, you know, a few times. It really depends, though, on, you know, if the air is really dirty, your mask is going to get kind of dirty faster. So it depends on how dirty the air is. But usually you can kind of tell when it gets a little harder to breathe through your mask, it's time to get a new one. But usually 3 uses is probably enough.
Got
for
it.
One mask.
Thank you so much, Dr. Schmidt.
Sure.
Dr. Rebecca Schmidt is an epidemiologist with UC Davis and the lead scientist in an ongoing study researching the effects of wildfire smoke on pregnancies in Northern California. Up next, we'll meet a clinic in Sacramento County that is one of the few helping new Ukrainian refugees, more than 3 months since the unprovoked Russian invasion turned war. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Schlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. In the more than 3 months since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the UN Refugee Agency estimates 15 million have been displaced, and more than 7 million of whom have crossed the Ukrainian border as refugees. The majority are in Europe. However, it is safe to say thousands have arrived in California, and specifically Sacramento, which is home to one of the largest Ukrainian immigrant populations in the country. A clinic in Sacramento County is one of the few helping refugees navigate a new country, language, and culture, all while enduring trauma and uncertainty. Kate Lefko is with the Social Care Department at Ellica Health Centers and joins us about their work and what the need is right now. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on your show. I really appreciate it.
We appreciate you being here, Kate. If you can give us a backstory, what is Ellica Health Centers and who do you all serve?
Well, we mainly focus on the underserved, underinsured population here in Sacramento. Ellica was established in 1978, so we're over four decades old here. And it started with just a single tiny office of one provider donating his time to make sure that everybody has access to medical care. And it's now grown. We are 10 locations around Sacramento and 4 mobile units. And we're really working hard to make sure that people have a way of getting good quality healthcare services, no matter of their income, no matter of their insurance, no matter if they speak English or not, so on and so forth.
How many patients or people do you serve?
So in 2021, we served 47,127 patients, and this year to date, it's been 31,277.
Wow, that's incredible. And it's not just medical care, correct? You offer other services as well?
Yes, that's correct. We also have dental. we have behavioral health services as well as case management services, our mobile units that are serving our homeless populations actually have a veterinarian on staff, as well as at the resource center where you have a community closet and a food pantry that we're able to provide those resources to patients as well.
Hmm. I was reading on your website, and Elika has visitors coming in from surrounding counties like Yolo and Placer, but even that they get, you all get calls from like New York and Oregon as well. So even across the country. When did you first become aware of Elika Health Center?
Actually, about 17 years ago, when I first moved to United States with my family as a refugee from Ukraine, we came to Elika as patients, and we were able to speak to a medical assistant who actually spoke our language, and she explained how the process is and what we should expect and how things are done, and kind of taking us step by step. And I remember the time being very confusing, and me being 12 and speaking very, very minimal English when my parents spoke none, and kind of having to navigate the system. And, you know, it's kind of scary, especially as a child, like it's scary.
Yeah.
So I remember having someone who was like, it's okay, I'll explain it, don't worry, kind of, and feeling like we're going to be taken care of. Later when I, you know, grew up and after going to school and everything, I was able to apply to Elika and actually get a position here and be able to serve the same community that I came from and learn how diverse actually Sacramento is because of how diverse our patients are, and being able to come across some amazing people and hear their sometimes amazing, sometimes heartbreaking stories, and being able to help. I think it's absolutely mind-blowing.
Yeah, just looking back to 12 years ago when you were a patient and how this is coming full circle, and now you have this intimate understanding, having like actually lived through it and now giving back and walking other refugees through it. When it comes to Ukrainian refugees over the last 3 months, how many people have you all helped?
So at the resource center, we served over 2,000 clients. Some of them became Elika patients later on, but you don't have to be a patient of ours if you need help. If you need guidance, we could always help and explain things to you. And being able to see those over 2,000 people that came in, it was amazing how little they have when they cross the border. Sometimes they come with just the clothes on their backs and that's it. And they're starting from scratch.
Yeah. I go back to 12 years ago when you were a patient and you really spoke about the language and the value of speaking the language. Can you kind of explain what you're seeing from the more than 2,000 people that have literally been uprooted and they're now here more than 6,000 miles away?
Well, they don't speak the language, obviously. They speak Ukrainian. They understand Russian. They don't understand the culture. Where I come from, it's very different. I usually say that, you know, people in the United States are very smiley people, right? You smile and greet everyone. It's not like that in former USSR countries. If you're smiling for no reason, you're kind of looking like you're crazy. so they're portrayed as like grumpy people, which they're not. They're very welcoming. If you're ever invited for a tea at a Ukrainian family, you'll walk out full, kind of like Thanksgiving dinner, full. So they're very welcoming, but they're super stressed out, and that really shows. So the money, you know, the banking system is different. The healthcare system is different. The way you rent a house or space, that's different, because where we come from, there are no background checks for that. You don't have to have a credit history. That's something that's having a credit score that's absolutely foreign to them. You know, it's everyday mundane things, like knowing the difference between a check and a cashier's check or a money order. Those things don't really exist where we come from. So just explaining and navigating through those things, as well as, you know, getting a driver's license. Like, we all know how stressful DMV could be, right? Imagine if you sometimes have no supporting paperwork and you were here, right? applying for social services, you know, through Department of Human Assistance, like health insurance, you know, if you have little children, cash aid, applying for children to go to school. Like, there are so many things and little hoops that you have to jump through in order for that. You know, we think of it as simple and everyday because we're kind of used to the way that things are done here in the United States. Those people are not. So every single letter that comes in and it's not in the language that they understand, they freak out. And they run here with the letter and like, could you explain what this is? Why did I get it? Like, did I do something wrong? And just the stress on devastation in people's eyes, that's just heartbreaking.
Yeah. And all while navigating trauma. I mean, when you're talking about healthcare, the DMV, I mean, that's frustrating for anyone. And also, I would imagine just basic necessities. I mean, you said at the beginning that they're coming with practically nothing.
Yes. And imagine coming to a brand new life with, best case scenario, a carry-on bag. And you're renting an apartment and you're walking in and there's nothing and you don't have money to buy anything because, I mean, an average monthly salary in Ukraine is like $100. So even if you took your whole, you know, month earnings and brought it with you, it's basically nothing here. Like, you can't really afford anything here. So starting with little things like, you know, hygiene products, right? Like shampoos and soaps and toothbrushes and toothpaste, like having access to that is difficult for them sometimes. Hmm.
Are there any personal stories that resonate with you more than others in the months that you've been helping this specific group?
Yes. We've had a family come in actually yesterday, brand new to the United States, and they were looking for baby formula because there wasn't any in the stores, and when there was some, they weren't able to afford because
it's expensive.
We were actually very lucky and had some donated to where we could actually share some with the family. The mom cried, like she seriously cried. And it's such a little thing that we were able to do compared to everything that's happening to them. But she cried and she was so happy and walking out. And on top of that, you know, she was able to get some baby clothes and she was able to get a little bassinet for the child and, you know, just little things to kind of help them settle in, and, you know, a pack of diapers and, you know, those little things. But she cried. She couldn't believe that it was for free, that she doesn't have to pay anything for it. She was absolutely overwhelmed when she found out that it was actually donated by people who don't even know her. She was absolutely overwhelmed, but when she found out that many of the people that actually donated that they are not even Slavic, it was from a community who really cares. So just the happy tears in the eyes, it gets me every time. People walk out and we're here then huddling together, kind of wiping the tears ourselves, because just the stories and people being able to walk out and finding things that they need, that's a lot. I mean, it touches so many lives. It's so beneficial.
Yeah. I mean, you definitely are making a difference in every little moment like that. That is so powerful and important. But what I was hearing from that person that you helped, or that mother that you helped, I mean, and you touched upon this in the beginning, there's a great deal of stress. Does Elika also offer emotional or trauma support?
Yes, we have licensed clinical social workers who are able to counsel patients through what's happening. Not many choose to talk to them, unfortunately, because there's a lot of, you know, stigma with like mental health in former USSR countries. That's not really something that we talk about a lot. And just, you know, sometimes being able to bringing it up and just kind of saying, hey, if you need someone to talk to, we do have someone that you could talk to. Sometimes it's just them kind of crying and venting to us here and just kind of explaining and kind of getting it off of their chest. And we do highly support them when they do choose to make those appointments, and getting them interpretation services, and making sure that they have a ride to those appointments so they could actually, get here. If not, we try to schedule phone appointments so they could still talk to someone, and making sure that there is translation services for those visits as well.
I mean, I'm just hearing that language is so profoundly important when making someone feel supported and welcome.
It's language and cultural awareness mainly. But if somebody is trying to help you and you don't understand what they're telling you to do or where to go, it's not much of a help. So I'm so happy that I'm able to work in a department where we speak so many languages. I think at the moment we have staff that speaks 13 different languages.
Wow.
We've counted up. So, on a big scale, it's not that much, but like when you're thinking we're a department of 20 and there are 13 languages here. So it's amazing how people come in and they're able to get help and understanding of what to do.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Kate Levko, the Social Care Department Supervisor at Ellica Health Centers, which has been helping Ukrainian refugees in Sacramento County. If people are listening and they want to help, what's the best way to help and donate?
We're actually always needing hygiene products. So soaps, shampoos, toothbrushes, toothpaste, feminine hygiene products, new socks and underwear, t-shirts, they go really fast. Just comfy clothes. We have a lot of the pretty going out or, interview type of clothing, like business casual, business professional. But when it comes to, a family coming in and just starting their lives, it's just pajamas, toys, shoes, like comfy shoes, sneakers, or flip-flops. It's those things.
Yeah. Are there big challenges like housing, given everything just across California, but also Sacramento?
Finding housing is super difficult. It is a huge challenge. We actually see families of like five or six renting a single room sometimes because they're not able to afford anything more than that. So, if anybody has low-income housing, please reach out to us. We'll find families that could, really benefit from it.
Kate, you mentioned that you immigrated here 17 years ago. Do you still have family in Ukraine?
Yes, I do. I actually have my aunts and uncles that are still there. Some were able to leave Ukraine for the time to keep their minor children safe. Some weren't able to. And, they're currently in the midst of things happening. And I come from Zaporizhia. So it's very close. And we do have, like, on the outskirts of city, there's a lot of bombing going on. And they actually started bombing into the city now. A couple of schools have been bombed. We had a rehabilitation center that has been bombed. Train station, a children's refugee center. It's difficult.
Yeah. Are you able to still communicate with them?
Yes, actually, my day starts and ends with me checking in with them. In the mornings, it's when it's morning here, it's evening there. So I check in and say, "Hey, how was your day?" And when it's evening, they're just waking up. So I'm just making sure how the night went and that they're okay. And sirens are constantly going off at night. So it's not much happening during the day. It's usually they start bombing or flying over when it's night. So it's a lot of mental stress when you hear those like bomb sirens going off at night constantly.
Yeah. How are you doing? This war has been going on for over 3 months and your day starts with calling your family who are there and can't get out.
I think I'm still numb. It got to a point where like I couldn't sleep for like 2 or 3 weeks, for more than like an hour or two because of all the stress, and I still can't believe it. It's absolutely shocking to me. I still cannot believe it. I know it's been going on for a long time. I think it's still like denial or something. I don't know. to me, it's so unbelievable because I visited my family not that long ago. I've been there. I've seen those places, and Ukraine is absolutely beautiful. The architecture is amazing. Like you think it's like it's a third world country. Like you don't expect much from it, but the architecture is absolutely beautiful. The culture is so unique and bright and colorful, and seeing how the beautiful cities that I've visited are now just leveled with the ground. It's heartbreaking to me. And it's a small country. It's smaller than Texas. Like we're tiny. Yeah.
I would also imagine that when you're helping refugees that are coming from Ukraine with a similar story like yours, that it helps give you, I don't know, it comforts you during a time that's just atrocious and uncertain.
It does bring me comfort because I'm making a difference to people who are struggling right now. It comforts me that I'm still lucky that I could help my family there. Because I have access to, you know, so much here. So, you know, just making a difference is always this, you know, bright light at the end of whatever horror is happening in the midst of this war.
Well, we are lucky to have you. Thank you so much, Kate.
Thank you so much for letting me join and share a story.
Kate Levko is with Ellica Health Centers. Their 10 clinics and 4 mobile health units in Sacramento County have been helping Ukrainian refugees. Still ahead, CAP Radio's Donna Apadoni shares her interview with author Craig McNamara about his memoir, Because Our Fathers Lied, a memoir of truth and family from Vietnam to today. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The Vietnam War shaped a generation. It brought people together for protests. It also tore families apart, in part because of deaths and injuries, but also because of disagreements on the necessity of the war. One family that had a particularly contentious wartime relationship was that of Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. He was the architect of the Vietnam War and responsible for its escalation. His son, Craig, actively and adamantly protested the war. That rift made for some awkward situations, as documented in Craig McNamara's memoir, Because Our Fathers Lied. CAP Radio host Donna Apadoni talked with Craig McNamara, who is a farmer in the Central Valley and is here to share their conversation. Good morning, Donna.
Hi, Vicky. Nice to be here.
Yeah, from everything that I've learned about the Vietnam era, I haven't really explored how it impacted families with different views of the war, not to mention to be the anti-war child of someone who was such a war hawk with direct involvement in the Vietnam War.
Oh, yeah, that must have been very difficult. And by the way, in Vietnam, they call it the American War. That's a totally different perspective. The whole point of Craig McNamara's book is to point out that there were differences, to point out that there were a lot of things he wished his father had done differently, but also to point out that there was a really strong love between his father and him. I thought when I picked up the book that I would be reading some very angry words, but it's not at all an angry book.
No, it's a love story with... In any relationship, the challenges that all relationships have. And, you know, my mother and father are outstanding people and tremendous models, and like all of us, flawed. And the memoir, I think, takes you through that journey.
It's a memoir, but there's also a lot of history. He did a lot of research going into this book, so that makes it quite an interesting read. And by the way, we didn't plan it this way, but this would have been Robert McNamara's birthday. He was born 106 years ago today. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So it's falling on his birthday. How old was Craig when the war started?
He's 72 now, so he was 10 when his father was appointed Secretary of Defense, and he was around 15, 16 when the things really started to ramp up in the mid-60s.
Well, as we just heard from him, it's a love story, but it's also a memoir about a father and son who were on opposing sides of the Vietnam War. How did they navigate those differences?
Every family has its own dynamic. And for the McNamara clan, it meant father and son didn't talk much about the war. They were a very outdoor, sporty, nature-loving family. So they shared that, and that love kept going. But Craig said he could never get his father to talk about the war in any depth. While it was going on, or even in the years long, many years after the war was over, I wondered if his father was maybe trying to protect him.
Well, I do believe that within families, the stories need to be told when they're age appropriate. So maybe as a 15 or 16-year-old, as you, the Secretary of Defense, are continuing the war effort, sending more and more troops, doing much more bombing, dropping napalm and using Agent Orange, maybe that is not the appropriate time to share your concerns with your son. But as a 21-year-old, a 31-year-old, a 41-year-old, a 51-year-old, a 61-year-old, those are the times that a father and son need to break down the barriers and share what you hold, because the war was a tragedy, not just for the 58,000 men and women, our U.S. soldiers who were killed, but for the 2 to 3 million Vietnamese and Laotians who were killed. And I want to remind our listeners here that we dropped 7.5 million tons of bombs on Vietnam. That's three times the amount that we were used in World War II. That's a tragedy for all involved. So I think it was incumbent upon my father to engage in dialogue with me, and that never happened.
I think what I'm hearing is a lack of closure between him and his father.
Yeah, definitely a lack of closure and just some sadness that it was such an important topic for their family, for the entire world, and a painful gap because they never really got to discuss that. It was interesting. Craig told me that he was rather surprised by his father's loyalty to the two presidents under whom he served, Kennedy and Johnson. Robert McNamara's loyalty to the president sometimes almost sounds in the book like it was bigger than his commitment to the war. So I had to ask why Craig thought his father kept going.
My understanding in speaking with incredible historians and leaders like Daniel Ellsberg and others is that it's quite probable that had President Kennedy lived and won re-election, which he most likely would have done, that together he and my father would have ended the Vietnam War.
So it was a Johnson thing.
Well, I think it was an escalation thing. Remember, no president wants to lose a war. Kennedy didn't want to lose a war. Johnson certainly didn't want to lose a war. And yet Johnson had an agenda that was so far beyond the war. So your question is, why did he keep going? During the time that he worked at Ford Motor Company as part of the Whiz Kids, he achieved a tremendous amount. He was thought of as a complete brainiac. And I think when he came into the JFK administration, he looked up to JFK. He admired him and wanted to do the best job that he could for that president. And upon his death, wanted to do the same for Johnson. So there may have been a power element going on there. Mm.
Okay, so I have a better understanding of that loyalty, but did Robert McNamara believe that he was actually doing the right thing?
I'm not sure what he thought while the war was going on, but years after the war was over, Robert McNamara said he was wrong. And from everything that I've ever read about him, I thought that was an enormous, significant admission. Craig McNamara thought a larger apology was in order, so I asked him what he would have wanted his father to do.
He needed to go much farther than an apology or that I was wrong. Those are the initial steps that a person needs to take when you've caused such tragedy as was caused under his tenure as Secretary of Defense. What I wanted him to do was to apologize to the families, to the veterans who had come home damaged and injured, to the families who suffered loss. I wanted him to do something formidable for those families, to ensure that every veteran in wars to come would have the resources to help them become well. I wanted him to ameliorate the situation of the napalm and the Agent Orange, pay forward for the damage that was done backwards.
Yeah. That brings me to the title, Because Our Fathers Lied. Is that why Craig titled his memoir?
It's a totally different story, but the backstory to the title is really interesting. Let's listen.
The title of my book, Because Our Fathers Lied, is an amazing, it resonates with me. And I found it as part of a poem by Rudyard Kipling. And the poem is entitled Epitaphs of the War, 1914 to 1918. In the research that I did, I discovered that Rudyard Kipling's son wanted to enlist in World War I. However, like myself, he wore glasses, and he was not able to enlist because of that. Rudyard went to the higher-ups and was able to pave the way so that his son could enlist. The story that I've heard, the history that I've heard, is that the son, while in combat, his glasses fell off and the son was killed. So it's the sorrow that Rudyard felt over the lie that he told on behalf of his son. So people have asked me, why did I use Because Our Fathers Lied? And I used it because it was a direct quote from Rudyard Kipling. And I used it because our fathers do lie. It wasn't just my father who lied. And I thank you for pointing out the fact that my father is one of a very few in history who have come forward and said that he was wrong.
Robert McNamara died in 2009. Did you get a sense of why Craig waited more than a decade to write about his father?
Yeah, I wondered about that, too. I asked him about it a little bit different way, though. I asked him if he thought he could have written the book while his father was alive and what his father might have thought of the book.
What I think about is if he were here in this room today, if he had read my memoir, what would he feel? How would he respond? Would he be tremendously saddened? Would he feel that I've betrayed him? I don't think he would.
You know, this is a unique story in many ways, and it gives me a different look at the Vietnam War. But it's also a story that a lot of families can relate to, and there are parallels today with a lot of many issues that we could talk about exhaustively. But it's a relationship between father and son. It's very much about the differences between generations. They never really talked about the war, right?
No, that really never happened. And in part, that seemed to be the way Robert McNamara operated. And it reflects what happens in a lot of families.
My father and I, on the exterior, didn't have confrontation, and that's because we followed his pattern. And I have a funny story. My mother, who is absolutely the most wonderful person in all of our lives, and I just want to pause here for a second. I dedicated my book to my mom, and the dedication reads, "To Margaret McKinstry Craig, she gave me her maiden name, her Pacific blue eyes, and her love of nature. It is her love that has guided my life's journey." And my mom, God love her, and dad loved to play tennis. The truth be told, my mom was better, and she could beat my father, but she always let him win. Now, if that's kind of a 1940s, 50s sort of relationship, I guess it is. And when my mom died, it was February of 1981. My dad and I went out to an indoor tennis court around Washington D.C. People play indoor tennis courts all the time. And he was depressed, and I let him win. And in the car on the way back to his home, it was quiet. And he turned to me and said, "Well, Craig, how are you and Julie doing?" My wife, Julie. And I said, "Well, Dad, we're fine. Occasionally, we have problems." There was a pause, and he said, "Your mother and I never had any problems." So I think that's emblematic of the generation. And you deal with those generational issues, and there's a lot of stuff there that you're not going to change.
Yeah, I definitely can relate to that within my own family. In the last 30 seconds or so that we have, Donna, Craig is a farmer in our area.
Yeah, a pretty big farmer, 450 acres of walnut farm in Winters. He fell in love with agriculture when he was younger and lived in South America. He's in a lot of leadership roles. He's on a lot of boards of organizations, not just in our area, around the world. He is just so intense on what he does and so into it. And it just raised so many questions for me. If I could interview him again, it would be about regenerative farming. I have a lot to learn.
I have a feeling you're going to interview him again.
Maybe.
Donna, thank you so much.
Nice to be here.
And we have a link to Donna's story and the memoir, Because Our Fathers Lied. That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.